Hi, everybody. Adrian Gostick here, author of Anxiety at Work, and we welcome you to the panel today. We're going to be talking about workforce, workplace, and well-being, how we create a culture of care, and we have an amazing panel. Let me just do a quick introduction of who will be on our panel today. We have Nabil Extabalon, who's the Executive Vice President of People and Corporate Affairs for Walmart Canada and their 100,000 associates. We have Andy Holmes, Global Head of Well-Being for Reckitt. We have Callie Kersey, who's Vice President of HR for Zebra Technologies. Julie Sperlin, Senior Vice President of HR for Software AG. And joining us from Venice is Alina Donnarumma, Head of Diversity, Inclusion, and Social Impact for IIT. Now, we're going to bring everybody into our panel right now, and thank you to HR leaders for sponsoring our panel today. And we're going to begin. Well, welcome everybody. Now, Lena, unfortunately, we're having a little bit of technical issues with in Venice, but we'll hopefully get her back. But we're going to go around just for a minute. We're going to start with Nabila, and just tell us a little bit about why this issue is so important to you and to Walmart Canada, and then we'll go to Andy and Callie, and then to Julie.
Thank you, Adrian. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today. So really, this is the epicenter of all of our people and corporate affairs strategies. Well-being is the epicenter of our strategies, and that's because we hold two really important beliefs. First of all, we don't believe there's a trade-off between well-being and growth. We think that well-being is a catalyst for growth. And second of all, we think to build organizational resilience, it really starts with one thing. It starts with the resilience of each and every one of our 100,000 associates. And so what we all want is organizational resilience, to not just to carry us through the pandemic, but to carry us through social unrest, political uncertainty, climate change. And really that starts with the resilience of each and every one of our associates. So that's why we're passionate about this and why I'm personally passionate about it as well. Thanks, Adrian.
Andy.
Thank you. Thank you, Adrian. And real pleasure to be invited to be on the panel today. I think at Reckitt, you know, everything we do is about people first. You know, we stand for doing the right thing always. And that goes to our products, the way we work with our customers, our consumers, but also the way that we look to enable our people internally as well. One of the things that I think we've all learned through COVID, but, you know, more acutely is that, you know, well-being is the foundation of what allows us to be at our best more of the time. And not only do we owe that as a commitment to our employees, who are, of course, under our care, but it represents, as Nabila says, a huge opportunity and an upside, not just to elevate performance, but to elevate fulfillment and to elevate a sense of being and thriving across the organization. So, you know, well-being for us is much broader than just being free of illness. It's about a sense of purpose and about a sense of how people feel and experience Reckitt on a day-to-day basis.
Very nice. Kelly.
Hi, yes, Callie Kang, well, Kersey. I should say, formerly of Zebra Technologies, this is a very personal journey. I myself, and I think Nabila said something about resilience, I crashed and burned after nearly 2 years of madness. And I can share some of that as we go along. But I've left a wonderful company, really very much similar to Andy, you know, people first. Wholly related to purpose, hence the company's done very, very well, even during a pandemic. And one of the things that we've definitely learned, you can create a culture of care, but if you don't walk the talk, the evidence isn't there. So really listen and actually change the way we understand people's motivations. For the first time, I think we realized at Zebra, we were being invited into people's kitchens, living rooms, cats, dogs, but you know, we separate ourselves from that. So actually it changed the company's relationship. And suddenly I would say we didn't necessarily say we didn't see people as individuals, but it was a very different moment and a different dialogue on what really motivates everybody.
Well said. Great. Well, welcome. And Julie.
Well, I would just chime in on the end here that I agree with what everyone said. And I do think it's such a pivotal moment for all of us as employees, as leaders, that things today are much different than they've ever been. And it's a real opportunity for us to bring empathy back to the workplace. Something that I think through the 90s and 2000s, it sort of eroded over time, and it was, you know, leave your worries at the door. Well, that's not bringing the whole person to work. So not only has Software AG been going through the global pandemic, but we've also been going through our own internal transformation as a 50-year-old software company. So you kind of have layers and layers of the different stresses, and learning to recognize the individual stressors and what motivates folks helps to bring their whole person to work and create a better cohesion as a team. And then, as Nabila said, the resilience comes.
Love it. Well, thanks, Julia. And thanks, everybody, for being here. So we're going to jump in. I'm going to start with my good friend, Nabila. I'm going to want to push you a little bit, because you have done so much with wellness at Walmart Canada. And so I'm really interested, how have you destigmatized this conversation around well-being while really focusing in on psychological safety, getting people to open up about their mental health? Can you take us through a little bit of the specifics of your journey and what we can learn?
Absolutely, happy to. So I've personally, again, a little bit of personal disclosure, I've personally struggled with anxiety for over 10 years. And I had, you know, I've always had amazing companies that I've worked for, amazing bosses, but I was really stuck in kind of the brand I had built for myself. And I couldn't personally break that brand by, you know, sharing my personal struggles, until I changed jobs and I joined Walmart Canada a year ago. And I decided to be as authentic and transparent about my experience as I possibly could. So I introduced myself to over 100,000 associates in my new role as someone who was struggled with anxiety and who also was a recovering workaholic. I didn't understand at the time how significant that was going to be, not just for the organization, but I think for the retail industry as a whole, as we were obviously essential workers and dealing with the heat and the height of the pandemic. And since then, we've really unleashed a ripple effect. But it started with destigmatizing starts with leaders at the top. You know, there's no other way of doing it. You really, as I think executives, as senior leaders, those of us who have a position of privilege, who've gone through these journeys, I have one very simple message. Let's all just stop pretending. Let's stop pretending, like Kelly shared, that these things don't affect us, that we're not human, that we don't have these struggles ourselves, either ourselves personally or those are in our loved ones and our families. And let's be honest and transparent about those things and how we're dealing with them, so that we create the psychological safety for others to do the same. I want to share, Adrian, just really quickly. I started this journey with sharing my own personal journey, but also really challenged my executive team and our leadership team at Walmart Canada. And we started our well-being journey a year ago, and we just did a post kind of, we did a pre and post, you know, survey. And in the year that we've been on this journey with the senior leadership team at Walmart Canada, they have reported a 28% increase in self-compassion, a 26% increase in focus, a 16% increase in psychological safety, and an 11% increase in ability to prioritize and manage my time, all while providing essential services through a global pandemic. I think that's a pretty telling, some pretty telling outcomes for the impact of this focus and what it can have on the business and people.
Anybody add to what Nabila is saying?
I think spot on. I mean, sort of very similar dialogue, maybe a slightly different approach. We, you know, certainly at Zebra, one of the things that, you know, everyone's talking about the great resignation. We haven't quite seen that. I might be one of them, but my own reasons. We haven't actually seen that. We made it very comfortable. We spent a lot of time virtually talking about mental health. We changed the way we were doing our leadership programs and made wellness a big key part for our leaders to feel comfortable having those conversations. You know, we're not therapists, but we are human beings. We can have that conversation. And we definitely notice things, you know, when people say, oh, people are working from home. I'd say actually we overworked in the last 18 months. If anything, we've got to Nabila's point of view, everyone was a workaholic. We've got to reteach, you know, kind of how we manage our days, but actually being open about it, talking about it, including myself. I've had anxiety issues. I found out late in life I was neurodiverse, and coming from a very highly educated driven Indian culture, to admit that you have something called dyslexia was very, very hard. But being open and showing people that actually I'm not as resilient. This is tough. I've never faced anything like the pandemic. Really helped. Walking the talk, leaders actually saying, you know, hey, I haven't got all the answers. We've got to work at this together. And I think also, you know, for the first time, we also kind of really, even with my own team, even though I know them well, I realized the demands of care, you know, whether it was childcare, whether it was elderly parents. We kind of have conversations, but I actually visibly could see them. So it did lead the company to kind of give rest days. We gave people flexible Friday, which was just usually summers. We put it through the whole year and said, you know, you do what it takes for you to manage life. So, you know, my hat's off to Walmart for leading some of the way. And Walmart's a big customer, so we work very closely.
No, go ahead, Andy.
No, I was just going to say there's a couple of points there that I suppose really make my ears prick up. The first, I think, is the way that Nabila, you articulated, you've approached it with Walmart Canada. I think one thing I've experienced through lots of panels and conversations is that a lot of organizations start out with the right intent from a well-being perspective, but then measure it the wrong way. Mm. And depending on the way you measure it, depends on the outcomes and the focus you then end up getting. So many organizations start with good well-being intent and then measure it by compliance. You know, for me and for what we're doing at Reckitt, we made a conscious decision that well-being was opt-in. It wasn't opt-out. And I think that set a very different tone. Now, I'm not going to lie and say that that was incredibly comfortable for everyone in the organization, because when you're investing money and people and heads and all the rest of it, there's an inherent want to be able to calibrate and work out what's coming back. But I think in this space, it's certainly one that corporates need to take a step back and say, what we're doing is investing for the greater good. What we're doing is investing for sustainable human capacity or sustainable behaviors, which then become culture. And you don't put pressure on that by squeezing timelines and trying to get the return quicker and quicker. So that was one thing. I think the second piece was about, you know, the focus on the very human side of it. You know, I haven't had a long history with, you know, some of the experiences that you guys have talked to. But one thing I did have through the lockdown was we had two miscarriages in lockdown. One was very traumatic, resulted in my wife being admitted into A&E and, you know, having an operation. But at all the time, we had no one to reach out to. We couldn't have people to the house. We couldn't connect with loved ones. It was incredibly difficult. And I myself went through an experience of knowing what I should be doing, but not feeling capable to reach out and grab something. And I think what that taught me and the way we've approached things at Reckitt is that you can have the best solutions in place. You can have all of the barriers removed, but that doesn't mean that the person who's desperate and needs it is going to be able to reach out and grab it. And so it's being very, very sensitive and very understanding of the nuances and the sensitivities around humans, rather than just thinking, well, it's there, it's fit for purpose, therefore it should work. It's not like that. And I think that's a really big thing that corporate needs to get their head around, that this isn't an exact science. People are different, they're complex. And therefore you have to approach it in that light.
Well, thank you, Andy, for your vulnerability and sharing that with us. Julie, any further thoughts on measurement? That's really curious what Andy's bringing up. How do you measure something as kind of nebulous as well-being?
Well, I think it's tough. And I think that all of us have sort of struggled to figure that out. And because I think it's interesting whenever you do polling, right? It's people who are usually already actively engaged, or the polar opposite of, I think everything stinks, are the ones that tend to respond. So that's one of the things that we've seen we do at the annual survey, and we've tailored some of the questions through the COVID pandemic to try to get to some of that, you know, feeling supported, et cetera, and having what I need. And that was it. You know, we saw a little bit of the polar, yes, very much appreciative, or, you know, again, everything a little bit negative. So I think it's hard to get that middle. And I think, Andy, you talked about it, that oftentimes the people that need these programs the most are the least equipped to reach out and do it, right? Like, they might be such in a spot of stickiness that they can't reach out, or they don't know, or there's an embarrassment factor, or a number of things. And I think that that's what we're trying to do, too, is to take away any of the stigma or the guilt or the whatever that comes with saying, no, I can't take on another project. No, I can't do that. Thank you for considering me, but no. The different ways that they need to kind of protect both their work cycles and their psychological safety. I think that's where we're trying to focus. And I think that's where hopefully we will see the return in time. One of the early things that we did is we were looking, like many companies, at, oh, well, how's our productivity now that we've gone home, right? I think a lot of people looked at that. And, you know, it was fantastic, right? We looked at, we're like, we're almost seeing more, especially out of R&D. And then there was the, wait a minute, is that a good thing? Probably not entirely. So well done. We did a great job of safely taking everyone home, but we didn't necessarily plan for the exhaustion, the overexertion, and the overwork. So I think that's where we've spent this second year trying to look at how do we recalibrate that and define what success looks like against, you know, the overall exhaustion that everyone's seeing.
Well, and I will ask Julie, I mean, you know, you're saying we, I'm guessing you mean a lot, not only your leadership team that you're part of, but HR. How do you get wellness out of HR and into the wider organization? How have you done that?
Great question. And if anybody has tips, no. You know, it's one of these things where I don't care whether it is, you know, attrition, any of these things are like, okay, HR, what are you doing about this? We're losing people. What are you going to do? Excuse me. And I think it's one of these things where I'm like, HR can offer tools and resources and things like that. However, it's incumbent upon everyone in the organization to set a tone of acceptance and participation. So I think that's one of the things that we've done well is we have a number of groups, like we have a change network team of individuals from across the organization. Again, I mentioned our transformation. So we were going to do that anyway, but those change networkers have had to take on an additional level of support and things for the organization, which is not only transforming, but transforming our workplace against the ongoing pandemic, against the new hybrid approach to work and what that will mean. So we have networks like that. We have our DE&I ambassadors that I think, again, are playing a critical voice out to the organization. Our executive leadership team also, you know, I'm part of that. And I sit there and I'm like, all of you on this call are responsible for helping us carry the water. We can't do it alone because everybody in HR knows that you can have the best, you know, laid plan on a page, but unless the leadership supports it, people will not feel empowered to take a part of it. They will not feel like they can participate without getting, you know, scrutiny or some other kind of backlash potentially from their leadership. So getting that leadership buy-in and making sure that they are also ambassadors of all of the kind of initiatives that we're doing, I think is one of our critical pieces that we're doing.
What else would our panel add? Nabila, how are you getting this out of HR and into the field?
Yeah, I think this has been one of the things I reflect on, and I think it's been a success in our journey. So when we initially set off on this journey, we started at the top, as I mentioned, started with building belief in our executive team through their own lived experiences. And the statistics I shared with you at the beginning are their reported outcomes. So they've lived it. They've experienced it. They see the power of the focus themselves. So no one has, there's no sales pitch in this. They're advocates as a result of their own lived experiences and results. From there, I think to operationalize it, to Andy's point, to make this isn't about well-being programs, this isn't about productivity. We actually had an internal well-being summit where we invited compliance, health and safety, our operators, our frontline leaders, people, total rewards. You know, we invited this cross-section of functions together and we all asked the question, you know, what do we believe to be true? Do we have a shared belief? What's the difference between well-being and wellness? What are the components of well-being? And how do we build a movement, not a program, a movement to put well-being at the center of our culture? And how do we create, you know, this aspiration as an organization to improve the overall well-being of each and every one of our associates? That is a much bigger ambition than creating a well-being program. And that's the journey that we're on. And I would, you know, very, I think that kind of internal summit, the starting at the top, you know, giving our leaders a chance to have their own lived experiences and see the personal effects of what well-being can do for them, has really been a big change driver. And just to give you an indication, when we had our first kind of kickoff to our field, so we launched this movement first at the top and then to our field a few months later. Our CEO, we had a whole day training for our top 2,000 leaders, and our CEO stayed through the whole thing. You know, he didn't just come at the beginning and say his piece and leave. He stayed through the whole thing, and he continues to stay through the whole thing every time we have a focus on this. So I think that's really what's made the difference for us.
And I think to Nabila's point, I think one of the lessons we learned, you know, you think of things as programs, but actually this isn't a program. This has got to be part of your DNA and not look at it as your welfare approach. And similar things, you know, we used employee resource groups to kind of have proper dialogue. We have subject matter experts like the compliance, and, you know, they can give you that infrastructure, but actually talking to employees. We spend a lot of time with leaders. You know, I'm a leader, I have a team, and I didn't have the answers. And helping leaders to kind of have much more compassion and not always worry about the productivity, which is a difficult thing to say. You know, we do want to get our revenue, but change the dialogue. I think a lesson we learned, and I'm again, don't get the violin out, but one of the lessons I learned is we really have to stop people and think about self-care. We don't do enough of that until something crashes and burns. And we realized that people were so worried about their jobs, they were so over-indexed of the 24/7 culture. We did do some fun things like, hey, we're going to switch off the internet at 6 o'clock on Thursday. I can tell you the heartache. But we did also get our CEO to front a lot of these dialogues, and he talked about sort of being trapped in his home and you know how that felt. So sharing personal and making it way beyond a program makes a difference.
Can I just jump in on that, because I want to throw something a little bit controversial, and we'll see how people respond to it. But you know, Adrian, you asked the question, how do we get this to live outside of HR? HR are widely recognized in most organizations as the people function. Sometimes that's people enablement, sometimes that's people disablement. You know, it depends on how good the HR function is. But one of the things that, and I think, Callie, you just alluded to it, is that there's always going to be this tension between well-being and performance. And the reality is, for me, I think a lot of organizations are trying to fix symptoms without actually understanding the cause. So when you look from a well-being perspective, you know, we have metrics around, let's say, D&I. But what the business is trying to do is drive business through collaboration. Now, how different are collaboration and D&I? You know, both are about embracing different opinions, different point of views, different perspectives for the greater good, and having each voice counting equal. So when you start to look at that, for me, to get it to exist in the functions is, how do you provide well-being not just as a responsibility, but as a massive opportunity? So if you think about collaboration, D&I is absolutely integral to that. That comes from a place of bias, a place of how resourced are we from a well-being perspective. When you look at innovation, that's about the ability to experiment and express and try new things. That's about psychological safety. Guess what? That comes from well-being. So it's about, how do you change the narrative around well-being? So instead of it just being about, let's take care of our people, it's about, how do we enable our people to smash through the ceiling that they think is currently there? Because that then becomes aspirational, empowering, and exciting to people as well, whether that be execs, whether that be business owners, functional leads, or indeed HR. So for me, there are two pieces. We can't ignore the tension that exists. So it's, how do we change the narrative so that it captures both?
Well, you know, and I love, go ahead, Nabila.
I want to challenge that. I agree with everything, but I want to challenge a bit that comment, because I think this is the underlying this belief, starting with what we believe to be true, right? If we believe there's a tension between well-being and growth, well-being and productivity, well-being and sales targets, well, if we believe that tension to be true, that, you know, one trades off the other, that is the underlying misconception and myth that we need to bust. Because then we're always making trade-offs. And especially when things get tough, when sales are down or we're in a crisis, that's when we start to pull back programs and support. And that's the complete opposite of what we should do. It's in times of crisis, it's when sales are down, it's when people are struggling and under pressure, we need to increase our support, not decrease our support, because that's when they need the more resilience to perform. So I think that belief that I talked about at the beginning is that there is no trade-off between well-being and growth. well-being and performance, rather that we need the well-being, to Andy's point, to for our people to show up to perform, is the myth we need to bust. So if we all believe that to be true, then we act completely differently, and we see this whole journey in a completely different life. And I think that's what we need to change in the conversation.
No, I completely agree, Nibiru. I think, you know, what I'm saying is I believe they're the same thing, but I think different people have different lenses. So I think sometimes it's about, you know, either we can re-educate people or we can enable them to realize that we're actually coming from the same position with the same aspiration. Okay. It's just that we're trying to tackle it in a different way. So, you know, an example might be that, you know, if you wanted to increase collaboration, is forcing you to have representation from every function in one meeting room. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to collaborate with each other. What I'm saying is if we enable them through a well-being perspective to feel psychologically safe, to feel like they belong and that their opinions and experience are valued, that is what enables collaboration. So I think, you know, there is a piece to get it. It exists outside. It's about how do we ensure that people interpret the narrative and are motivated in the same way.
Absolutely. I just want to share, there's an amazing, for our audience, if you haven't seen it, there's an amazing Deloitte study that took the top S&P 500 companies and measured their investment in well-being versus their return. And many of these companies saw 6 times of an increase comparatively to their counterparts. So I think the science and the statistics and the data behind this business case is coming out and becoming more obvious. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to help everyone in changing the belief system.
And I love the conversation, Andy and Nabila, you're having, because this is what I'm hearing from some of my clients, is that empathy is really great and we really tried it, but then sales went down. And as the great American philosopher Mike Tyson once said, all the strategy in the world is great till somebody punches you in the face, right? So what do you do when that happens? Let's turn to Julie. I mean, how do you respond to that when, you know, empathy kind of gets thrown off the bus when maybe, you know, the sales or productivity or something is going down? What do we do?
Well, I think I was thinking about that when I was listening to Nabila and Andy talk as well, that I think it's how we order these things changes over time and when there's organizational stressors, right? So we used to be like, well, we make enough money, we can put these well-being programs in place, right? Or, well, we're not making money, so we're gonna have to cut back on these programs. And now I think we're looking at it at the inverse of, we need everyone's well-being in order to really springboard our collective success, to bring about, as Andy said, the innovation. So I think that's one of the things, is in light of the constraints, and I'll share very openly too, that at Software AG, not only were we going through COVID, but a year ago, we suffered a really, really unfortunate IT incident, a breach. Talk about stress on the entire organization. It was a bad one. It was a big one. It was nasty. And then you kind of rock the core too of not only the stress that people have, but now people are concerned about their data. It was a huge distraction. We lost a lot of time and focus, ability to support our customers. So in that moment where we had this like dual pandemic crisis kind of situation going on, we really had a choice to say, okay, we can't care. We need to get everybody back online. We need to take care of our customers first. But what we did is to really try to focus as well on the peace of mind of our employees, put some things in place to give them the tools and resources so they could kind of solidify the comfort level that they needed to back at home, and then come back to the office, get their equipment re-imaged, do all the things that we needed to do to kind of bring them back safely. Again, not easy when they're not in the office either, which was a whole other thing. But we tried to focus on our employees and understand the kind of questions that you're getting out there with early information, telling them, you know, we don't have all of the answers. And I think that vulnerability of the leadership was really critical in getting people bought into, okay, I believe you, I trust you, I know you're working on these things. It wasn't done in a black box. And I think that was one of the really important parts for us to be able to kind of keep the focus. Yes, we need to rectify, get the business engine back online and on track and humming, but we also needed to care for every single individual that was impacted by this, their personal safety, their family safety, and then get them back online. And I think that approach helped us not lose people too, right? People didn't vote with their feet when that happened because they understood that the company cared and was there to support them through this crisis on crisis situation. I just share that as an example. I wish that on no one, but if you ever do find yourself in those situations, I think taking that moment to stop and just say, okay, yes, business is critical. We need to pay the bills, but the people, we can't do that if we don't have our people. And that's kind of back to that reordering of things and realizing, as Nabila said, it's gotta be this undercurrent of everything that then gets built on foundationally. The trade-off really isn't a question. I think the companies that are looking at still as a trade-off are going to struggle.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. If we keep constantly see this as a cost, then it's a program and it's going to create other issues. But transparency is absolutely critical through a period like this. And one of the things that we saw different, and then maybe it's a different experience, we actually saw innovation go up because suddenly through the fact that, you know, you can involve more people, even though I'm a person who likes physical contact, we actually got ideas from places we never thought before of asking. So actually innovation went up. And the other piece I think we underestimate, actually our employees challenge some of the ways we did work. Mm-hmm. So some of our jobs have been the same for 30 years, let's put it this way, maybe with different tools. So we've spent, there's a lot more dialogue about sort of job design. Does it need to be done this way? Why am I doing it? There's a duplication. And it was coming from the workforce. I think we changed our way we engaged, our annual survey. You know, we were doing sort of pulse surveys, but we had short, sharp little questions and we made it personal to the team. So it wasn't the massive survey. So there was a little bit more intimacy. People wanted a bit more intimacy. I'm happy to share this, but I want to share it within my group. And just treating people like adults. Less tell, more ask, more dialogue. Definitely for us, Zebra's culture did show a significant change in the way we approach things.
That's terrific. I want to get to Andy. I want to ask you a question. There are times, you know, in fact, Nabila invited me and my co-author Chester last week to speak to her, all of her managers, because they're going through this, you know, what they call their golden quarter, like last quarter, right? So Andy, there are times where we have big surges of energy in our people. There are times where our people maybe lag in energy. How can you monitor that? How can you make sure we have a more consistent well-being experience for our folks?
Yeah, so it's a good one, and it's one actually, you know, we spent a lot of time discussing last week. We had one of our programs do a deep dive with our senior management teams to understand how it's landing with them, what sort of things they're implementing, what it's provoking in terms of consideration. And you know, where we got to is there's definitely a relationship between time and energy. And you know, when time compresses, energy spikes up. When time extends, then energy can go down, and that can be good and bad in different ways. I think the big thing is around self-awareness. You know, one of the biggest challenges we've got is building this sort of notion of self-awareness in our people. And the irony is that if you look at the science, the first thing that disappears when we're under-resourced from a well-being perspective is self-awareness. So our ability to self-regulate, self-calibrate, manage and judge our behavior consciously kind of disappears as we get these sort of lulls in kind of well-being or personal resource. So that's one of the things that I would say. One of the big conversations we've been having is about cadence and capacity. So if you look at your day architecture, the cadence of your day, there are certain things that your body is doing or pre-programmed to do in terms of flows and oscillations that a lot of the time, let's be honest, we're working against without realizing it. And that becomes quite chronic and quite debilitating over a period of time. Get to a period like the golden quarter, like you were referring to in Nabila's context, and I guess for a lot of us, and you have a sort of a perfect storm almost. So this level of self-awareness, this acute awareness of what's the rhythm that we're expecting to perform in, and what are our bodies naturally there to do? So for individuals, having a level of self-awareness around, you know, when are my peak performance moments? When are my abilities to have real focus concentration versus when are my more sort of passive times or my more sort of, I suppose, reflective periods. And what we're trying to look at is how do we get leaders to be really acutely aware of, if I've got, for example, 4 hours in a day where I've got this acute sense of focus, where do I best deploy them and who with? And how do I create the environment to get the best out of those people? Because if someone's saying to you, look, I'm working 16 hours a day, the reality is, to Nabila's point, if you look at the science, you ain't being productive for 16 hours a day. So how do you create these, or maybe these catalyst moments of focus, and then allow downtime and recuperation and recovery, and then allow reflection in order that people can kind of come back into the mix? So there's a piece about the daily cadence. There's a piece around self-awareness, but there's also a piece around the business cadence as well. You know, we talk about mission mode. So if you're going into a period like Q4 where you know things are going to be crazy and you would normally do 10 things a day for yourself, don't expect to get those 10 things a day done. Don't set yourself up to fail at 6 of them. Set yourself up to win at 4. So, you know, how do you be realistic and pragmatic so that people feel not just like they're performing and achieving and focused, but they have a level of sustainability for themselves, but also a level of fulfillment that they're left with at the end of each day, because that's what gives you the sustainability and through those periods where resilience is required.
That's terrific. I think I have about 40 minutes of focus a day, but yeah, great. That's awesome. Yeah,
you and me both, Adrian.
So Andy, I love what you just said. And I think one of the things that we can do, you know, again, as HR, when we're coaching our leaders, is we have to make it okay if you're not feeling your best during a time. Say you have to have a tough conversation with someone, or you are scheduled for a one-on-one and you can't be present and you can't be there, or you're distracted by other things. Rearranging to optimize that time where you can be your best for the person and commit to them and give them that time, I think that's actually the most valuable gift you can give to them. Because if you show up anyway and you're not feeling it, they'll know it. And then really erodes the trust. If they feel like they're bothering you, again, that culture of care just goes right away. So it's better to say and set a tone of, I'm not sure I'm in the right frame of mind for this. Let's reschedule. Or I've got a lot going on. I'm going to make time, but I want to be sure that I can commit to you. So some of those small things that I think if culturally you can make it okay to say, I'm going through some stuff, right? That we can kind of set that time aside and really make the employees involved feel a lot more supported.
No, I think it's an incredibly important point, because I think more often than not now, because we're all remote, there's a lot of communication, there's a lot of dialogue, there's a lot of, pledging and statements. And all that does is it raises expectation. And if your day-to-day experience falls short of the expectation, what you breed is cynicism and skepticism and a lack of trust, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, exactly as you say, if you're not going to be able to deliver on your commitment to creating the experience for that other person, then rearrange it to a point that you can, because that breeds consistency. Consistency builds trust, and it builds a level of psychological safety. And I think that's where, when you link it in with the stuff that Nabila talks to around, you know, people being, very open and showing their humility and authenticity, that's where you get to a point where people start to trust their environment and feel like they can be themselves.
And that's why things like, self-care, we call it moments for me. It's okay to say that. And I think, you know, we just have to be much more comfortable as organizations to allow people to have those conversations with us.
That's terrific. Nabila, what would you add here?
Yeah, I mean, I echo the sentiment everyone shared. One of the activities to leave the audience with that we did is we asked our leaders to build their baseline. So these are basically the things that you must maintain to protect your personal health and well-being. And so, it's simple things that you make sure I get. For me, one of my baseline items is sleeping 7 hours a day. Like if I don't get 7 hours, I know that has a domino effect, right? Going outside at least 3 times a week, these types of things. So as an exercise, I built my baseline, all of my managers built theirs, we shared them with each other, and we have accountability partners. I think that takes the conversation to another level, because you can get really specific and concrete with each other. Are you protecting your baseline? Do you need to renegotiate timelines? Do you need to renegotiate commitments? You know, if you're not protecting your baseline, what's causing that? How will you help people very concretely with overload? So that they not only, they have I think to Andy's point, they have an increased level of self-awareness. And I think also stress is not bad. you know, stress, I think, is, I love what you said, Andy, those mission moments, right? Stress is a natural byproduct of high performance. We're all going to experience stress. It's the accumulated stress that is dangerous. And in order for people to know when to change something, they have to have an increased level of self-awareness. And I think that baselining activity really helped us. The other thing, you know, we're committed to is training 1,000 of our leaders to, on mental health first aid. To educate them, to help them even know more deeply the signs of mental health and what to do with clear tools and actions. So we're on that journey to train 1,000 leaders on mental health first aid. So we have a mental health first aid certified leader in every part of our organization.
That's just terrific. Hey, we are about 5 minutes from ending, so we want to end on a high note with some real practical tips and tools that listeners can listen to. So I'm sure there's some folks out there going, look, we're not Walmart Canada. We're not Wreck-It with all your employees, all your resources. How do I get started here in my little company? Or you know, if resources are tight, how do I get really started? And what are the things that I could be doing right now? And what I've found working with large organizations is sometimes our resources are even more constrained. So that's a little bit of a fallacy, I think. But what can we do to get started right now? So Kelly, I'm going to start with you. And let's just go around. If you were giving advice to some of our HR leaders out there, what would you tell them? Get started with this and this and this.
I think we've touched on some of those, but some of it is very, very simple. Is be open and honest where we've got answers, give people the support. You know, I'm not just talking about employee assistant programs. I'm talking about training your leaders to understand sort of mental health. And we, you know, something very simple, because we've got manufacturing staff. I call them stay dialogues. You know, where are you? Where is your journey? And show people that you care, I think helps. And if somebody just wants to, we've also, you know, we did some what I call stress busters in terms of, hey, you need 2 weeks off. You don't need to ask, just give it. Recognize where your people are and constantly open and transparent. We also work with, you know, big customers like Walmart. They want to know what you're doing. But simple, keep it simple. But absolutely have the conversation. It's not about fancy programs. It's about having that dialogue and by the people that employees matter, the manager, their functional groups. I'll let
Lovely.
The rest of the team add.
Well, thank you for being here, Kelly, and for your vulnerability and sharing your story as well. That's great. Julie, let's go to you. What advice would you have for the HR leaders listening?
Sure. I think there's some really just brass tacks, and Callie mentioned things like EAP. You know, we had to take a look and actually look at we're in 40 countries, I think, and we're about 5,000 employees just for a relative scale. So in some of our places, it's relatively small. So under our health and wellness plans, we didn't actually have an EAP in every country. So that was something we would think that it is sort of table stakes these days, but take a look and ensure that you do have the access for folks in all of your regions to get something if they need the help and if they're inclined to reach out. So that's like a bare bones thing. Don't take for granted that you have it. Make sure you take a look and make a concerted effort that it's something that's available everywhere. Kind of beyond those tactical things of what comes in generally in our plans, I do think the to make it more of a movement, as Nabila said, as well, instead of programs, that you really show up, especially as leaders, in an authentic way, that you do talk, and I really appreciate Callie sharing her story too, that you talk about your own struggles and that it's okay to not be okay all the time. It's okay to say, I can't be on camera. So creating that safe place for people to actually be wherever they are in that day, I think is one of the really organic things that we can do. It's no longer a situation, as I said in the beginning, where, you know, we expect people to leave their problems at home. Well, you know, I am at home, I'm here. So they are with me all the time. And maybe there's goodness that comes to that too. My dog shows up on camera and it gives everybody a moment of levity. Those things are great. And I don't want to be somewhere that it's not, right? And that's what a lot of employees are feeling. So starting with that natural tendency to just allow and meet people wherever they are for that day, create that safe space. And then the other things will come of creating the belonging, because when people trust that you have their best interest at heart, they're more likely to kind of be a little bit more in and be a little bit more committed, if not a lot more committed, when they trust you in that way.
Thank you, Julie. And thank you for being on today and sharing your insights. Amazing. Andy, what have we missed? Where would you start if you were, starting this process right now?
It's a great question. I think the first thing for me would be clear about your choices. One of our partners said to me one day, they said, in saying no to something, you're actually saying yes to something else. So whether that be at an organizational, a leadership or a personal level, be very clear about what your choice is. If it's people or profit and it comes to the crunch, which is your choice going to be? The other thing is that, well-being is about choices. It's about personal choice and it enables choice as well. So without well-being, we become a passenger of ourselves and we lack the ability to make consistent and balanced choices for ourselves. That has a big impact. So well-being is absolutely about choice. The second piece I would say is, and this was another CEO actually when I was in Australia spoke to me, and he said, be known for one thing and leave loudly. And what he meant by that was be known for one thing in that once you've made your choices and you've chosen, whether that be I only work to a certain time or I always take my lunch breaks or I prioritize my sleep like Nabila or whatever else. For me, my morning time with my son is absolutely critical. I don't compromise. Once you've made your choice, be loud about it. Don't be apologetic for it. So if you decline a meeting, use your narrative to say, I'm declining because I'm putting this first. Not, I'm sorry, I can't because. It's a slight nuance, but it makes a massive difference to, do I own it? Am I showing my authenticity? And am I congruent with my values? Because like we said before, if it's not, people will smell it. So choice, and then be known for one thing and leave loudly.
Love it, Andy. And thank you again for joining us and for your insights. And I love that. Be known for one thing and be loud. I love it. my good friend Nabila, I leave the last word for you. If you were starting this journey again, what have you learned that maybe you would do differently or you wanted to pass on here?
Yeah, I think for everyone here, big or small, start with what you believe to be true. Anchor the belief. I think if you start with that, that's really the thing that catalyst for thing. And then destigmatize the conversation by being an example or finding those examples within your organization and amplify their voices. Those two things don't cost you anything. And then I think educate and re-educate, do some myth busting, really make sure that people can have the increased self-awareness that they need. I think the one thing, we're definitely on this journey. I think this is a journey as an individual for all of our 100,000 associates. It's a journey for us as an organization. And I think it's a societal journey that we all need to go on in all our respective communities as well. So, one of the things we need to continue to do is really challenge the ecosystem. I have a youngster in my family who is struggling, and the youngest person is under 15. And I suggested they talk to someone, and they were like, absolutely not. You don't talk to therapists, unless something's really wrong. So we have a big journey ahead of us, and this is a movement. So I think as organizations and enterprise, we need to play our role in this, but it goes well beyond the workplace. And so I hope we're all a catalyst for this movement.
Well, thank you, Nabila, not only for being with us today, but for all you're doing for your 100,000 associates at Walmart Canada. Thank you. Sincerely, you are a true inspiration. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And in about 10 minutes, the next session starts, which is People Analytics, How to Dissect Complex HR Data into Digestible and Actionable Insights. So it sounds like a great session. I hope you stick around for that. Once more, thank you to everybody who has joined us. And I think the idea is take some of these ideas. Let's see what we can do to help some of our people be well and live with a little bit more care this coming week. So thank you to everybody. Take care.